Well, let's go ahead and get started. It's that time. It's good to see everyone that's here. It's getting harder to come, evidently, and everything. Got a few less people, it seems like, each week. So you guys are the brave ones who are sticking it out and everything. I'll try to talk a little bit louder tonight to keep us awake and all of that. Let's pray and we'll get started. Father, thank you so much for who you are. Thank you that where we have questions, you have answers. I pray that you would use this time this evening to help us understand how people around us and sometimes even we think about things and help us to see through them a little clearer for what they really are, and help prepare us for the next time we're together when we talk about what you have to say about this issue of how does death relate to life. Speak to each one of us tonight in just the way you want to, in Jesus' name, amen. Well, we are talking about mortality, or how does death relate to life. Some of you have heard of J.I. Packer, James Packer, before. Written a lot of really good books. He's a great teacher. He's been one of my favorite writers. I've never had the privilege of studying under him personally, but reading a lot of the things he's written, very profound, very good guy. Listen to what he has to say on this subject. He says, death is the fundamental human problem. Okay? Death is the fundamental human problem, for if death is final, if that's all there is, nothing is worthwhile save self-indulgence. And no philosophy or religion which cannot come to terms with death is any real use to us. Wow. Pretty powerful words. He says this is the fundamental problem that we have to deal with as human beings. What is death? How does life that we live relate to death? Is there life after death? What is after death, if anything? He says, in any philosophy or religion who doesn't have a good, reasonable, authoritative answer for that is of no use to us whatsoever. So as we go through these alternate worldviews in a few minutes, I want you to consider, do they have any worthwhile, reasonable, authoritative answers to this question of how does death relate to life? There in your notes on the very first page is this focus on a person again. And the first person we want to focus on is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She was born in Switzerland. You'll see there about her, she was born in 1926, died in 2004, just 10 years ago, she passed away. And some of you have maybe never heard of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She's written over 20 books on the subject of how does death relate to life. She grew up in Switzerland, and when she was a young girl, teenager, before she moved on into her career and college and that sort of thing, it was at the very end of World War II, and she volunteered to go into concentration camps that had been set free and help people who literally were so wounded and so depleted physically that they could not leave even though they had been liberated. They just couldn't do it. Physically, they couldn't do it. And she volunteered to go into these camps in both Poland and Germany and work with people and help them. A lot of those people died while she was there. And she was there with them by their bedside. She was a very compassionate lady, very caring, and she did not shy away from the hard thing of being there with people when they were on the brink of death and then when they died. She was with them to the end whenever she could be. that gives you a little bit of a picture of her heart. She had a tremendous heart for people and cared about people. Well, after that experience, she decided to go into medicine. So she went to the University of Zurich there in Switzerland, majored in medicine, but decided partway through that that she wanted to help people who were wrestling with things other than just physically. So she ends up going into psychiatry eventually. She makes her way to New York in the United States, where she takes her residency practice and begins to work with people. And she is appalled at how the medical profession in her day, when she was going through med school and then when she was in residency, how hospitals particularly were dealing with people who were terminal. She just was appalled at that. And she set out to do something about it in whatever small way she could in the hospital she was in, or hospitals that she ended up being in. She was ridiculed by the medical community incessantly. She was chastised by superiors. We don't have time for you to spend with them and sit there and talk with them and that sort of thing. We just don't have time for you to do that. And so she got into all kinds of trouble socially, in her job, and all of that as well because of this. But in 1969, she wrote a book from some of her experiences with people who were terminal, and it was called On Death and Dying. And it became an instant bestseller internationally, 20 different languages within the first couple of years of its publication. It went all over the world. I mean, she was from Western Europe. She lived in America. So Western Europe and America particularly, it just saturated this little book On Death and Dying, became a classic. And she started talking about it and how important it was to care for those who were terminal and to have a compassionate heart for them. And she really single-handedly changed the attitude of the medical profession in America toward terminal ill patients. And a lot of things have happened since then because of her. Now, that's the good side of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You have to realize she started writing in 1969, and she wrote right up until she died in 2004. It's a lot of years, writing over 20 books during that time. And the books kept progressing more and more. It starts off with people who are facing death, and by the time her last book has to do with what about life after death. And she covered everything in between in all of those books that she wrote. And her own opinions and views began to change. And you could see, if you read her books, you see the developmental process she's going through as she thinks about this over that long period of time. And so she starts off thinking one thing, but by the end of her life, she's in a very different place than she was. Now, one of the things you need to understand, when going all the way back, when she was in those concentration camps, the thing that she kept seeing drawn on the walls in the concentration camps were butterflies. And she worked in several camps in different countries. And she would see the same thing, butterflies, butterflies, butterflies. And she started asking, what are the butterflies for? And the people who could still talk to her and express, who had been there, said, you know how a creepy crawler goes in and has a cocoon develop, and then they become a butterfly and they're set free? It's like they go into the cocoon and it's like going into death, and then they come alive as a butterfly. And they kept telling her, that's what we drew in the concentration camps, on the walls, on the bunks, and everything else, to say there's got to be something after this. This is death, but there's got to be something after this that gave them hope. So that really impacted her life we're going to see some of that language even coming out as she progresses in her thinking about on death and dying. When she first started writing about death and dying, she was mainly dealing with what she called the stages of grief. What kind of process do we go through when we lose someone to death? And she talked about the stages of grief. And then she talked about the stages of life. And the last stage of life, she said later on in one of her later book, was death. That death was the final stage of life. It was final. It was not something to be dreaded. And she talked about annihilation. That's just all there is. And then later on, as she gets closer to her own death, the butterfly language starts coming up again in her writings. And she starts talking about there's something after death. We exist in some form after death as well. And she started looking forward to that. So she really progressed a lot. Now, the reason I'm telling you so much about her is because you're going to see her quoted, I believe, in every one of these alternate worldviews. You're going to say, well, Rick, which one is she? Well, at some point in her life, she was all of them. Because she kept transitioning, kept moving, kept changing, kept developing what she was thinking on this subject. But I want to tell you, to this day, if you take a course on death and dying in a university, which they never even offered them before Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, but almost every major university, any college of any size whatsoever, in America today and in Western Europe, are going to offer courses called On Death and Dying after the name of her first book. And that is usually one of the standard textbooks that you have to read along with some of the other things that she wrote. She's really had a phenomenal impact upon this question in a lot of people's minds. When it comes to humanism, which we're going to get there, the last view we're going to look at today when we talk about humanism a little bit more, we need to remember that the poster child for humanism, when it came to that very first question, where did we come from, was who? Who was the poster child? Who? Darwin. Charles Darwin was the poster child. He gave some kind of intellectual credibility to answer that question of where did we come from? He's never really dealt with the subject completely, but at least he gave a visible credibility, a seeming credibility to answer that question. When it comes to how do we change, B.F. Skinner was the poster child. How do we change? We change people's environment. We can't change as people. We can only change our environment, and we will eventually respond to that environment differently. Change is only something that can happen on the outside, not on the inside. We can train our faculties to do something different, but we're never going to change on the inside. And he gave scientific credibility for those who were looking for it in an atheistic world. When it comes to this question, how does death relate to life? Guess who the poster child is for humanism? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She is the poster child for this question in an atheistic world, increasingly atheistic world that we live in today. Had the privilege of going to a medical conference in the 1980s where she was speaking. And I have to tell you, she struck me as a woman who had a phenomenally compassionate heart. She cared about people. But it was equally disturbing to me of the words that came out of her mouth. And she was already getting into her butterfly, and she started talking about our bodies will go back to the ground, but our consciousness, our soul will continue to live on. And we won't really die in that sense, the real essence of who we are. Based upon what? Because I just want it to be that way. Seems like it ought to be that way. So, anyway, that's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Let's look at some of the views now, these five different alternate worldviews. The first one is a personal theistic substitute for God. They believe in a personal God. That God is theistic in the sense if you ask them, is there a God, they would say yes. And that God is personal. It's a person in some form or fashion. Deism, finite godism would be two of the primary ones that we look at here. So number one, there is a personal creator God who created the universe, including mankind. Deism and finite godism would agree with that. Number two, this creator God has revealed himself in his creation, and mankind must figure him and his design out through common sense and observing his created design. So God has revealed himself in general revelation. Some of you are saying, Rick, we've gone over this before. At the end of this semester, I hope it is so drilled into all of our minds what each of these views think about that we can talk about it. What does a deist believe? Finite goddess and that sort of thing. What do they believe? Because I want us to be able to hear it and spot it. And they just basically say God has revealed himself, and we got to work real hard through common sense, through observation, education to figure it all out. We got to do that. We think about deism often. I mean, we'll usually quote folks from the 1700s, and we will down at the bottom of this page as well. We're going to talk about two people, David Hume and Thomas Paine from the 1700s. We're going to quote them where they talk about this. But let me read you something from somebody in the 20th century. This was written just a few years ago by a Jewish rabbi in America. The title, his Harold Kushner. Some of you know what book he wrote, but it's When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Here is a quote out of his book. God finished his work of creating eons ago and left the rest to us. Sound familiar? I hope if you were reading his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, you would read that statement and say, deism. Finite godism. It's got to be one of those two. He goes on and he says, residual chaos, chance, and mischance, things happening for no reason will continue to be with us. The kind of evil that Milton Steinberg has called the still unremoved scaffolding of the edifice of God's Christianity. In that case, we will simply have to learn to live with it, sustained and comforted by the knowledge that the earthquake and the accident, like the murder and the robbery, are not the will of God, but represent that aspect of reality which stands independent of his will and which angers and saddens God even as it angers and saddens us. God has nothing to do with the earthquake, the accident, any of that. He has nothing to do with any of that. That's all man's doing. We're just making a mess of things. In that essence, he's saying, God created all this. Now it's up to us. And God is standing back watching us make a mess of everything. Basically what he says. That's not the 1700s. That's now. That's someone who is having an influence right now in our midst. Number three, God has probably, would you underline that word probably? This is from their vantage point. God has probably provided mankind to live after death, but without specific revelation from God himself, there is no way of knowing for sure. Most people, in other words, who are deists or finite goddess, who believe God created, set it all in motion, stepped back, and he's uninvolved, that means he couldn't give us the book with the specific information about life after death. But most of them have been impacted by the book. Most of them have read the book, have read the Bible, been influenced by it, and most of them would say, we think there probably will be life after death. We just can't say for sure, but it seems like there ought to be. That seems like common sense and everything they might say, and therefore, that's what we think will probably happen. Some would be dogmatic. Yes, it's going to happen, but they don't have a leg to stand on. There is nothing authoritative to back them up if they reject the Bible when it comes to that. So you could say, well, a lot of them believe in Jesus and Jesus rose from the dead. How do we know that? It's recorded in the book. And if we don't have the book, we can't really say that happened for sure from their vantage point. Some people have said, well, Rick, what about death, near-death experiences? In fact, there's a movie out right now that's very popular, a book based on a book that was very popular. My wife loved the book. I haven't read it and everything. But I want to tell you, near-death experiences are just that, near-death experiences. And there are a lot of explanations for why people have some of the experiences they do that have nothing to do necessarily with God. And I'm not kiboshing all of it, but I do want to make this point. Someone's experience, no matter what it is, good, bad, or ugly, never should be given authority like the scriptures are. Experience is never authoritative like the scriptures are. Never is. We need to understand that. Somebody else's experience, never will I ever look at that and say, that has as much authority to tell me what's true as what the Bible does. So I would be careful, is all I'm saying, about near-death experiences. By the way, most of us have only heard about the good near-death experiences. You ought to read some of the literature on the other side of the coin. They are nightmares beyond belief, some of them, and everything. And they start with a bright light. Number four, mankind must figure out what God expects of mankind in order to live after death, if there is indeed life after death. This often leads to, so we got to figure out what God expects of us if there is. We got to cover our bases. We don't know for sure if there's life after death, but if there is life after death, we better be prepared for it. We better cover our bases. So what does that lead to? How do we cover our bases? How do we make sure, according to them? I mentioned four things. Working hard to make sure that one's good outweighs his bad actions. Okay? We got to be, there's at the end of life, there's of the scales of life, the good has to weigh more than the bad for a lot of them. That's what they think, which is very interesting. You know what other major religion in the world believes that? Islam. That's exactly the picture they paint. At the end of life, Allah is going to measure all the things we do, and if our good outweighs our bad, we get to go to heaven and be with him. Now, if you want to be sure to go there, they have certain things you can do, one-time events that will guarantee that you go there. But generally speaking, if you want, your good has to outweigh your bad. Another way, comparing oneself to others around them to compare goodness. None of us ever do that at all. We don't compare ourselves to other people and say, well, I'm better than most people I know, or I'm better than those people, and that sort of thing. But that's exactly what we fall into when we start playing this game of, I've got to have more good than bad in my life. Well, I'm better than most people. By the way, tell me how your goodness is today. Are you at 62% goodness? How do you measure that? How do you measure that? The reality is you never know. You never know exactly where you're at. So what do? We fall into this trap of, well, I'm better than most people I know. We play that little game along the way. By the way, Harold Kushner, the Jewish rabbi that I just quoted from a minute ago, one of the things that caused him to write the book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, was the fact that he lost a young child. And he was trying to explain what he believed he ought to believe, how he ought to respond, what was going on for other people going through that same kind of an experience and everything. And in the book, one of the things he complains to God about is, God, I'm better than most people I know. Why would you take my son and not take theirs? Why would you do that? Why would you allow that to happen? Which is an interesting question for him to ask in the book, when earlier in the book, what I just quoted, God created it all and stepped back, and it's all up to us now. which means God isn't involved. So why would I complain that God took my son when he's not involved from that vantage point? It just is very inconsistent to me. Look at the third bullet point. Another thing we might do, hoping that one has been good enough, but never sure about it. There's always a big question mark about that. My dad believed that the way you got to heaven was more good than bad, and he believed that you needed to, in fact, he lived with the fear of dying and the last thing on his record being a sin, and he felt like if that happened, he would go to hell, no matter what else he had done. If you didn't have it all taken care of with God before you died, there was no chance of going. And there was always, I watched my dad live this agonizing life of always wondering if I've been good enough and if I'm going to make it. And his whole quasi-Christian life, was the Christian life for him was, I hope I'm good enough. I hope I'm good enough. Well, what about maturity, growing, developing, becoming more like Christ? Now, I just want to make sure I'm good enough. I want to make sure I don't mess up too much. That's what it became all about, which was a deadly way to live life. And the last one there, either blind confidence or fateful resignation, because one can never know for sure if there is life after death or what it takes to get there until one dies, and then it's too late to change anything. So one of these two things often happens. Blind confidence, I just know what's going to happen. Or the other thing, fateful resignation. I just don't know. I'll just have to wait and see. And it feels fateful in that regard. You just sort of, when you wake up, you hope that it, on the other side, they would say, I just hope that I was good enough. Now, let's look at some of that down below. We're going to see these last two parts of that, pieces of all of that we just looked at, but the last two things we just looked at, blind confidence and fateful resignation. Look at what David Hume, a famous self-proclaimed deist, said. Look at the underlined part there of that first quote. A future state is so far removed from our comprehension, and we have obscure an idea, no specific revelation, so obscure an idea of the manner in which we shall exist after the dissolution of the body, that all the reasons we can invent, however strong in themselves and however much assisted by education, are never able, with slow imaginations, to surmount this difficulty or bestow a sufficient authority and force on the idea. Do you get the idea of fateful resignation? We just will never know. And there's no way we will ever know about that. Look down a few lines further. He says, for I observe that men are everywhere concerned about what may happen after their death, provided it regard this world, and that there are few to whom their name, their family, their friends, and their country are in any period of time entirely indifferent. He's just saying what I said at the beginning. This is an issue everybody's dealing with. Everybody's dealing with it. And I think that that is something, by the way, if I could just slip a week ahead, a lesson ahead. Why did God allow death to be something that was spread out for mankind? He told Adam and Eve, if you eat of the fruit of the tree, you will die. They ate of the fruit of the tree. Did they die? Yes. They died in the sense of separation, separation of relationship with each other, separation from God. They hid from him. They ran from him instead of running to him as before. There was separation. But why didn't God just take their life right then? Why didn't God say, okay, if you eat of the fruit of the tree, when you turn 60, you're going to die? On your 60th birthday, that's it. Why didn't he do that? Why is it so random? Why is it so random? Why is it that 35 years ago today, a 5.5-year-old boy, our son Kyle, died? 5.5 years old, a good kid, a fun boy. Why? And why do others live to be 100 and whatever? Maybe they're quote-unquote good people, maybe they're not. When are we going to die? Sorry to be so exciting. But when is it going to happen? We don't know. And the longer we live our lives, the more that becomes a question that is very, very real. Now, sometimes when we're young, we think that all of life is before us, and we live as if life is eternal. But at some point in life, you realize there's more in the rearview mirror of your life than there is out the front windshield. And you start coming to grips with it, and it becomes very personal. It's not theoretical. It's real. This life that I live is going to come to an end. And I appreciate David Hume saying that is an issue, that's a serious issue we all wrestle with. It's part of the plague of mankind that we have to wrestle with that. And I think it is one of the plagues of most of the world, all the worldviews that we're going to be looking at tonight, for the very reason that J.I. Packer said. Because if you don't have an answer for that, whatever philosophy or religion you call yourself, you have no answers. You are worthless. Because that becomes the ultimate question. Where do we come from is always the first question, it seems. And they do progress, but this becomes the ultimate question that becomes a burr under the saddle of mankind. What is going to happen to us when we die? And everything. And he, David Hume, is just fateful resignation. We have so obscure an idea of the manner in which we shall exist after the dissolution of our body that all the reasons we can invent, however strong in themselves and however much assisted by education, are never able with slow imaginations to surmount this difficulty or bestow a sufficient authority or force on the ideas. We just don't know. And we won't know. Fateful resignation. Now look down at Thomas Paine. He's a little different. He's more of the blind conviction, blind optimism, blind confidence. He says this in the underlined part there. He says, I trouble not myself about the manner of future existence. I content myself with believing, even to positive conviction. He even uses the phrase that the power, capital P, that gave me existence is able to continue it in any form and manner he pleases, either with or without this body, and it appears more probable to me that I shall continue to exist hereafter. So, Mr. Paine, what's going to happen to you? Well, you know what? I just choose to believe with blind confidence. Blind conviction. I can't prove it. I don't have any reasons for it other than I just believe it's going to happen. I'm going to go on living in some form or fashion. And he talks about that with such confidence as we go through this. I had the opportunity at another medical convention that I went to a few years ago in Kansas City. There was a doctor who gave a lecture. And he started talking about, in this lecture, the death of his son. His son was in his early 20s, and he committed suicide. And he started talking about that, and he started tearing, and then he started having a hard time talking, and he just kept on going. And when he gets to the very end, he closed his hour-long lecture with this, probably half of it, was telling the story of his son and what he was like and how he died and how he's been dealing with it since then. And then at the very end, he made some statements very similar to this. He said, I know that my son is in a better place. And he closed. That was it. Well, afterwards, there were probably 1,000 of us in this auditorium listening to him. Afterwards, I made my way down front, and I waited in a long line. Finally, I got to him, and I said, I just want to thank you for having the courage to share your story about the loss of your son. I, too, have lost a son, and I just appreciate you having the courage to share that. I said, I do have one question for you, though, if you wouldn't mind me asking, and I do this with all due respect to you and what you've gone through. He said, sure. I said, you said you are confident that your son is in a better place. I says, what's the basis of your confidence? Confidence in what, or what is it? And he looked at me, and he got red-eyed, and he said, I just have to believe, or I couldn't go on. Based upon what? Nothing. Blind conviction. I've just got to believe it. I've just got to believe it. And there are a lot of people, when they talk about what they believe about life after death, it's blind conviction. I just have to believe there's something there. And that's very true of someone who has a deistic view of God. Even many people who would call themselves Christians, don't forget, down deep inside, their true theology is deism. They believe that God is the creator and everything else, but they live as if he is totally uninvolved in this world. They live as if this book has no authority whatsoever. They might even believe in Jesus and might even put their faith in him, but they don't believe God is involved. They can't really know for sure, and they will live with this blind confidence that there's just got to be something different, something better, or I couldn't keep on going. Okay, let's look at the next view. Sorry if I start preaching, okay? It's a very important subject to me. An impersonal theistic substitute for God. Is there a God? This person would say absolutely, and it. Now, they might even say he, but when you talk to them further, they're finding that they're talking about something impersonal, like the universe, that sort of thing. Panentheism would be that. Now, I want you to write down, look at number one, God or nature and the essence is the essence of the power and material of the universe, which has eternally existed, or God is made up of the visible universe, his body, and the invisible universe, his soul, and is in the process of becoming all it will become. The first part of that is pantheism. The second part is panentheism. But here's what I want you to write down. I want you to write down mystical pantheism. Mystical pantheism. Remember we've talked about columns 2 and 4? This impersonal theistic and the impersonal atheistic views of God sometimes are very similar, even refer to some of the same things like nature as being ultimate and as God and that sort of thing. It's just that the personal theistic substitute for God would say nature is God or the universe is God. The atheistic impersonal substitute for God would say nature is ultimate, but it's not God. And we're going to give a different title to it. But this one, we're going to see clearly mystical pantheism. This is where you start seeing a lot of mystical pantheism showing through, which is more of the Eastern religion than it is the modern day version of pantheism in the Western world that we'll look at in a few minutes. Number two, all that exists, including humans, is part of the eternality called God, and therefore all things, including humans, are equal in some form. Would you underline those last three words? In some form. That little word form starts taking a lot of, especially when you start talking about this subject of how does death relate to life, and you read their literature, they start talking about forms a lot. And what they're talking about is this body that I have, I am a form. This table is a form. This paper is a form. This mug is a form. We are all just forms of this universe. And we are all equal. I have no more value than this piece of hardwood right here, or this piece of clay. I have no more value than that, and they don't have any more value than me. Everything is equal. We're all part of this universe, in some whichever one you want to look at, panentheism or pantheism. We're all part of this universe equally. We all just have different forms. All the people do, all the things that make up this universe are just a large collection of different kinds of forms. Okay? Now then, that becomes very important. So as humans, we are one form of the material existence, among many others that exist. Our material, this body that makes up this human form that I'm in right now, in the future will come back as a different form, or in a different form, or in different forms. I may go to be fertilizer and come up in the form of trees and plants. Okay? That sort of thing. And that's the way they would talk about that. And I move from one form to another. We should not consider one form better than another. I've talked about before. That would not be PC. To them, politically correct, to talk about me being any more significant than anything or anyone else in the universe and everything. Number three, birth and death are merely means by which the eternal keeps reforming itself. Would you underline reforming? It's reforming itself. It's constantly do that. So birth and death are merely means by which the eternal universe keeps reforming itself. This is usually called reincarnation or some form of ongoing material transformation. Sometimes it's even called consciousness transformation, which we'll see in just a second. Some will go so far as to talk about the material form will go back into the material part of the universe, but they will believe that the thinking, reason, logic, consciousness, they would often call it, of a person, goes into a collective consciousness. So look back at number one. Look at the second part of that where it says, or God is made up of the visible universe, his body, and the invisible universe, his soul. So panentheism is getting a resurgence today, partly through Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who talks at the end of her life in her books about my consciousness, my soul, is going to join the universal soul. And I will live on in that sense. But my physical body will not live on it as it is known. And what you see developing out of this is what we often hear today in terms of the cycles of life. Ever heard of that? The cycles of life, things just keep getting going around and around. How many of you have ever watched the little movie, The Lion King? Okay? Great little movie, I thought. I liked the movie. It was peppy, great music, some profound things in it and everything. But in The Lion King, it starts off with that phenomenal song of the circle of life. And the whole story is about the circle of life and how the old lion and everything dies, gets trampled, he dies, and he goes back. But then there comes a point in time that the lion's body goes to become part of the cycle of life. But later on in the movie, what sends Simba, the young lion, back home? It's seeing his father's soul, consciousness in the clouds, speaking to him in those very lion-like words and voice. And he says something like, Simba, you are not who you will become. Whoa. Wise words from the soul coming back to his son, the circle of life. And believe me, the Lion King believes in mystical pantheism and is teaching that. As much as I like the story and everything else, by the way, just as a word on that, when the father speaks to Simba as the mind or the soul of the universe and that cloud speaking to him and everything, when they have that scene developed in the story, they went back because it was so powerful and reworked the whole movie because they said the rest of the movie is trite compared to that. That was really profound. That was powerful. So they went back and reworked the entire movie around that scene, which is interesting, behind-the-scenes kind of information I enjoyed learning about. But anyway, let's look at the bottom. I've got a long quote there. If you'll notice underneath it, it says, Discourses by, I'll probably butcher his name, Meher Baba. If you do any research on mystical pantheism, you will see him quoted a lot. He's recognized by many in their circles as being a top authority. And so I've quoted from him. Let's look at the underlined sections there in that long quote. It says, in spite of their transitoriness, there is an unbroken continuity of life through these forms. You understand what he's talking about, forms. Old ones being discarded and new ones created for habitation and expression. The recurring incident of death is matched by the recurring incident of life, of birth. Old generations are replaced by new ones. Life is reborn in new forms, incessantly renewing and refreshing itself. The streams of life with their ancient origin are ever advancing onward through the forms which come and go like the waves of the ocean. Can you see the circle of life that he's talking about there? Now, skip down. The next quote, a couple lines down that's underlined. A sane attitude toward death is possible only if life is considered impersonally. Would you circle that word, impersonally? And without any attachment to particular forms. But this the worldly man finds difficult because of his entanglement with specific forms. Can I translate? What he's saying is, we get way too hung up on our physical bodies. And we just need to realize they're just part of the universe. They're no different than this table or this cup. We get too attached to them. We need to not take our physical body personally. I don't know about you, but that's a little hard not to take me personally in some form or fashion. But that's what they're saying. Don't take your physical form personally. It needs to be impersonal. And the problem is we get too attached to it and that sort of thing. Then look at the last paragraph that's underlined. The sorrow of death on closer analysis turns out to be rooted in what? Selfishness. The person who loses his beloved may know intellectually that life as a whole has elsewhere compensated for the loss, but his only feeling is, what is that to me? When a man looks at it from his own personal point of view, death becomes a cause for unending sorrow. From the point of view of life in general, from the universe, is an episode of minor importance. Do you really think the universe, God, really cares about the death of an individual, of a person? It's just part of life. Do you understand how Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, with this kind of thinking, wrote a book when she talked about the stages of life, and the final stage of life is death. That's the final stage of life. It's not after life. It's the final stage of life is death. That's just the way it is. And we just need to see it that way. You've lived a good life. Don't worry about the after all this and everything. Now then, I've got a couple of quotes by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at the bottom. She says this, "I've told my children that when I die to release balloons in the sky to celebrate that I graduated. For me, death is a graduation." This is later in her life, near the end of her life, where she sees this graduation taking place. And she will talk about her body will go to the ground, but her mind, her consciousness, she called it, will go, or sometimes she called it her soul, will go into the greater consciousness of God. She goes on and says below that, "Death is simply a shedding of the physical body like the butterfly shedding its cocoon." Sound familiar? "It is a transition to a higher state of consciousness where you continue to perceive, to understand, to laugh, and to be able to grow." So she says, my mind, my thinking, reason, logic, all of those kind of things, my consciousness is going to go on and it's going to continue to develop and function and grow and be a part of the greater whole, and that's going to be a great thing. And I need to separate that from my physical body, she says, which is going to shed itself. So it's my thinking that really. Can you understand how that is very similar to the next view we're going to look at in terms of a compromised view that we're going to look at in a second, a dualistic view and everything? Let's look at that. A compromised dualistic substitute for God. Number one, there are two equally coexisting eternal realities. Hopefully this is boring to you because you've heard it so many times, but just to repeat and remind us, the eternal material world, which is evil, and the eternal immaterial wisdom, which is mind, reason, thought, logic, which is good. My mind, reason, thought, logic, wisdom is eternal, and it is good. This physical body is eternal, and it is bad. It is evil. It will always be that way. Can you see why I talk about a compromised dualistic substitute? Because it's compromising some of the things that we just looked at and some of the things we're going to look at. It's sort of a blend of those in many different ways. Number two. The eternal immaterial wisdom is also often called the soul. Sound familiar to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and some of those writings that we just looked at. It's the soul of a person, and as such is considered good. Number three, both the evil material and immaterial soul will live on after physical death of the body. Now, that would be different than what we just looked at. They would say the mind, the soul, they would call it, will live on, what we just looked at. But this one says, but the material, which is eternal, my body, which is part of the eternal material world, it's evil, but it's going to keep on going because it's eternal. So it will keep on going as well. Number four, the evil material body of a person will live on through something like reincarnation as part of the eternal material world. A recycling of us in some form or fashion will take place. And number five, however, the immaterial soul will live on outside this world in a place of bliss, depending on how much it has grown through education, the study of philosophy, and on how separate it has kept itself from the evil material desires of the body in which it dwelt. So it had this blissful place that the soul or mind is going to go to and everything, and the body will just go back and become part of the evil material world that always existed and always will. Very similar to reincarnation, but at the same time different from some of the things we've looked at. So here we have at the bottom, that first long quote is from Plato. It's in one of his later works, Phaedo. I think that's the way you pronounce that. And he is, in this story, it's another story, like most of his are early on and everything, but most of his stories are conversations between Socrates and someone else or a group of people. And Socrates talking and asking questions and working the minds of people around him. Notice what he has Socrates saying in this. Let's start at the very beginning. Those who are judged to have lived a life of surpassing holiness, these are they who have released and set free from confinement in these regions of the earth and passing upward to their pure abode, make their dwelling upon the earth's surface. Okay? Now then, remember one thing I forgot to tell you. This is a conversation Socrates is having on the night that he drinks the hemlock. He had been condemned by the state for his political views, and he was given the opportunity to either be executed or by a certain date, which is this day that this story is written about, by midnight of this day, you have to have drank hemlock and killed yourself. Okay? And this is the evening when he has friends with him, and he is getting ready to drink the hemlock. So guess what he's thinking about? What's going to happen after I drink the hemlock? Then what? And that's what he's starting to talk about. So look at the underlined portion there, that first paragraph, and we'll read all the way through the rest of it. And of these, such as have purified themselves sufficiently, how? By philosophy, live thereafter altogether without bodies and reach habitations even more beautiful, which it is not easy to portray. Nor is there time to do so now. But the reasons which have already described provide ground enough, as you can see, Simmias, one of his friends, for leaving nothing undone in it to attain during life some measure of goodness and wisdom. For the prize is glorious and the hope is great. So he's describing this bliss that's going to be there. He goes on in the next paragraph. There is one way, then, in which a man can be free from all anxiety about the fate of his soul. If in life he has abandoned bodily pleasures and adornments, as foreign to his purpose and likely to do more harm than good, and has devoted himself to the pleasure of acquiring knowledge, and so by decking his soul not with a borrowed beauty, but with its own, with its self-control and goodness and courage and liberality and truth, has fitted himself to await his journey to the next world. He goes on, you will each make that journey someday in the future, but for me, the fated hour, as a tragic character might say, calls even now. In other words, it is about time that I took my bath. I prefer to have a bath before drinking the poison. He is trying to deal with this subject. What does he say? My mind's going to go to this great place, and it's been important in my life that I've devoted my life to building my mind, wisdom, knowledge, logic, and that sort of thing, so that that will be a greater part of me that goes on. If I haven't done that, there's not much of me that's going to go on and be part of this bliss and everything. Most of me will just go back into the evil material world in some form or fashion. Look at the very last sentence down there by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross again. When we have passed the tests we are sent to earth to learn, we are allowed to graduate. We are allowed to shed our body, which imprisons our souls. She talks about the body as if it is in a prison, holding our souls, our mind, logic, thinking, reason, that's wisdom, holding that in. And when we shed this body, it's going to set our minds, our souls, she refers to it, free. You can see how that is very consistent with what Socrates was talking about. Let's look at the next view. An impersonal atheistic substitute for God. These last two views we're looking at, if you ask them, do you believe in God? They would say, no, there is no God. But they have substitutes for God anyway. The first one we're going to look at would have an impersonal substitute in the sense that they might refer to nature, they might refer to the mind, they might refer to the environment, they might refer to history, some of those kinds of things. that's what they might refer to, which are not persons in any sense whatsoever. So number one, there is no creator God to look to, count on, or explain the existence of life. That's the atheistic part. Number two, mankind is part of something bigger. Would you underline that? Something bigger than themselves. And this something has certain godlike qualities that should be recognized and respected. Thirdly, the something greater than ourselves that has godlike qualities is not God, and there is no power. Or will that has made provision for mankind at death. So there, when we die, we just die. We just stop to exist. Well, what about our minds? What about what a lot of these people have called our consciousness or our soul? No, it just all dies. It's just all done. We live this life and that's it. Number four, death is simply annihilation of the human body and mind. They don't separate those two. There is no such thing as a soul to live on. Back under number one, would you write down scientific pantheism? Whereas view number two that we looked at tonight, the theistic, the impersonal theistic substitute for God, that was mystical. This is more scientific. The mystical believed that the body and soul would separate. The body and mind would separate. Scientific pantheism, which is more prevalent in America today, when you read their literature, you're going to find there isn't that separation. The body and mind are intact at death, and they both are annihilated. Number five. Five, mankind lives on in the sense that people leave an imprint on the world through their lives. How many times have we heard people say, how many times in media, listening to people speak, or going to a funeral and hearing people speak on someone's behalf, we've heard this statement something like this: well, they will live on through their children and through the people they touched. Now, there is a certain sense in which, yes, they had an imprint upon people around them. But often when you hear a statement like that, what they're saying is, and that's the only way they will live on, is through the memories and the imprint they've left upon other people. Because they themselves are annihilated. They're gone. Let's look at the bottom, these quotes from them. Read their own literature. This is taken from the World Pantheistic Movement, which there's a lot on the internet about that, and they have a whole organization. They have doctrinal statements. This is two of the points, I think, out of 10 or 12 points that they have in their belief statement in the World Pantheistic Movement. The World Pantheistic Movement is clearly scientific pantheism. They believe the mind and body are intact, and they both are annihilated at death. Look at points not five and six, though, dealing with this issue. There is a single kind of substance, energy, matter, which is vibrant and infinitely creative in all its forms. There's that word again. Body and mind are indivisibly united. So they make that point. We are different than mystical pantheism. We're different than Eastern religion pantheism. We believe, they make a whole point about the body and mind are intact. They're indivisibly united. You can't separate them. They're not Platonic. They're not mystical pantheism. They are the same. They stay together. Number six, we see death as the return to nature of our elements and the end of our existence as individuals. That's another way of saying annihilation. The forms of afterlife available to humans are natural ones in the natural world. Our actions, our ideas, and memories of us live on. According to what we do in our lives, our genes live on in our families, and our elements are endlessly recycled in nature. Okay? So they make a big point of that. What happens to us? How is death related to life? They're not related. You live and then you die and it's over. There is no more life whatsoever. Look at the last quote here from Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She says, dying is an integral part of life, as natural and predictable as being born. The next underlined part. We may be able to delay it, but we cannot escape it. We know less than other non-relational animals. Non-rational animals are destined to die at the end of our lives. And then at the very last there, that last three lines of, or four lines that are underlined, it is perhaps this inevitable and unpredictable quality that makes death so frightening to many people, especially those who put a high value on being in control of their own existence, or offended by the thought that they too are subject to the forces of death. For those who seek to understand it, death is a highly creative force. When she wrote about death as she moved on in her life, what did she just say? Death is a highly creative force, power. And she gives it in many certain deity qualities of power, of authority, of control over us. And she makes reference to it that way at different times. So how does death relate to life? It doesn't. We live, and when we die, we exist no more. We cease to exist in any form whatsoever, except in the memories and the things we've left behind that imprint other people. A personal atheistic substitute, the last one. A personal atheistic substitute. There is no creator God to look to count on, or to explain the existence of life, like we just talked about. Underneath that, I'd just write down Darwinianism and humanism. I would underline humanism. It's the prevalent one today. Most humanists are Darwinian, generally. Okay? And what I mean by that is, they're not Darwinian in the full-blown orb of that, of saying, really, what is ultimate is mankind, but they've taken that and drawn out of that, well, as part of mankind, I'm ultimate. And that's what humanism is. So most humanists get their humanism from a belief in Darwinian ideas that we as a human race are ultimate, therefore I'm part of the human race, therefore I am ultimate, and I'm accountable to no one or nothing else. Number two, mankind is a product which has risen to the top of the evolutionary mountain by the achieved superiority of previous beings before him. Mankind must accept his ultimate role in the universe. But bottom line, mankind is just another animal that will die. Number three, death is simply annihilation of the human body and mind. Hope that sounds familiar from the last one. There is no such thing as a soul to live on. Number four, mankind lives on in the sense that people leave an imprint on the world through their lives, through their genes and families, and through their thinking and writing and memories. Therefore, the goal is not to focus on death, but to make the most of life that we now know. Is there any difference of any significance in these last two views? No. They're virtually the same, because neither one of them believe in God, neither one of them believe in anything after this life. They both believe that the body and the mind or soul are intact. They are the same thing, part of the human person. And when we die, that's it. It's annihilation. So they're very similar in all that. I have a question, though, for both of these views. There's such an emphasis when you read their literature on this subject. We've got to leave things for the future. Why? Why? Let's say I leave a lot of good things for my children and their children down the road, and I have a very, what we might call, positive influence on a lot of people. Why is that so important? I'm leaving a positive imprint on people who are going to die. We're all going to die. So why is it so important for me to leave a positive imprint if that's all I believe that there is? It seems to a certain extent, if you move that out and think out about that, well, we want to make it a better world for our future generations and all that. Yeah, a better world to die in. I mean, there's a certain amount of futility in it, it seems to me, at some point. And quite frankly, it's what leads to what Epicurus promoted so much, a contemporary of Plato, when he said, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. He was basically saying, what difference does it make how we live our life? If the end result of everything is I'm going to die, just enjoy what I've got right now and live it up, and that's it. Because life is like a firecracker. I might as well make it a big one and enjoy it. Because it's just going to come to an end, it's going to pop and be over, and that's it. And it just seems like there's a certain amount of wishful thinking that somehow I'm going to live on through my children and grandchildren. It seems like there's a certain amount of incongruity of saying, I want to leave a positive influence on people so they can die. It just seems empty to me when we think about it that way. Look at these quick quotes down below. All taken from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Let me just read through them. We need to teach the next generation of children from day one that they are responsible for their lives. Mankind's greatest gift, also its greatest curse, is that we have free choice. We can make our choices build from love or from fear. She goes on, the second paragraph. Watching a peaceful death of a human being reminds us of a falling star, one of a million lights in the vast sky that flares up for a brief moment only to disappear in the endless night forever. This was earlier in her writings. Number three, it's only when we truly know and understand that we have a limited time on earth and that we have no way of knowing when our time is up, we will then begin to live each day to the fullest, as if it was the only one that we had. Now, is there anything wrong with living each day to the fullest? I don't think so. The question is, what does it mean to live each day to the fullest? What constitutes living each day to the fullest? The other question is, why is that important? Why is that important for me to do? The fourth little paragraph there. It is not the end of the physical body that should worry us. Rather, our concern must be to live while we're alive, to release our inner selves from the spiritual death that comes with leaving behind a facade designed to conform to external definitions of who and what we are. And the last one there, and after your death, when most of you for the first time realize this is after you die, you're going to realize something. That gives a clue right away. She thinks we're living on, okay? And after your death, when most of you for the first time realize what life here is all about, you will begin to see that your life here is almost nothing but the sum total of every choice you have made during every moment of your life. Your thoughts, which you are responsible for, are as real as your deeds. You will begin to realize that every word and every deed affects your life and has also touched thousands of other lives. So after we die, we're going to realize something, which means we have consciousness. We're going to be aware of things and everything, and that she is moving in that direction, which, by the way, I put it there to show you some of the progression of her thought. But then early on, she's saying, just make the most of this life while you got it, because this is all there is. By the end of her life, she's saying, we need to realize this isn't all, that our consciousness, our soul, is going to live on. And everything we do here is going to impact how and where and how much of that consciousness is going to develop and be left behind and everything. Now then, let me wrap up with some final thoughts here. Number one, apart from specific revelation from God, I'm talking about the Bible, unless there's any question. Apart from specific revelation from God, there is no way for mankind to know what lies beyond death. No one ever comes back to tell us about it. It's one of the things I appreciated about David Hume. He was a consistent deist. He said, "We don't know." Thomas Paine was overly optimistic with absolutely no foundation. He almost had to deny his own beliefs to be so positively convicted on everything. But at least David Hume says, look, we don't know. God set the world in motion. He put us here. And we have no way of knowing what's going to happen. We have no way of knowing if there is going to be life after death or not, what form it might be if there is life after death. We just don't know. And we won't know until we die. Now, that's pretty empty, pretty futile, but it's also honest. It's consistent with what his premise is that God has created, stepped back, he's uninvolved, and given us no information. David Hume truly believed what I'm often thankful for that God didn't do. He truly believed God created the world and said, now, good luck, I hope you can figure it out. He truly believed that. And lived that way and wrote that way. There it is. Hope you can figure it out. It's all on you. So, without specific revelation, without biblical authority. And again, I would just say, be careful about stories of near-death experiences. Okay? I don't want to say all of those are horrible or bad, or I don't want to say those are bad people, none of that. But I'm saying they do not have the authority to discern what is true that Scripture does. We need to be careful of that. They have no more authority than me saying I had an experience doing this, therefore it must be true for everybody, or it must be from God in some form or fashion. Number two, death and beyond death continue to be anomalies that frustrate both the feelings, creating fear, and the intelligence of mankind, creating doubt. Death and beyond death, and the questions about how does death relate to life, is always going to create fear and doubt within us. It's going to keep raising those questions. And I want to suggest to you, and that is good. It's good. It's very good. Apart from suicide, no one, and I would even debate this one as well, but when it comes to suicide, but really, do we really have control when we're going to die? How we're going to die, and that sort of thing. Do we really control that at all? And when we think about that, is it going to be this week, this year, this century? When's it going to be? Now, for me, I can say it's going to be this century sometime. But anyway. Number three, mankind has the illusion of controlling things in life. We trick our minds to believing that we can control things. I've mentioned before, I think, in here, faith is the language of God. Faith is the way God designed us to live in relationship with Him in a perfect way, to live by faith. When you read the teachings of Jesus, you see repeatedly, over and over again, in one form or another, Him talking about faith. We were made to live in a faith relationship with our Creator. Satan tempted us to step out of that faith relationship and to step into a control relationship with God, where we control him. Now, we don't control him, and we don't control the things that he does. But we live as human beings in this world of the illusion of control. We try to control our lives. We try to control people around us. And that is not how life was designed by God to live, to be lived. Us being in control. He is in control. Do I trust him to be in control or not? And that's the relationship, that's the design that he has for us, is to live in that kind of relationship. You are in control. I'm trusting you, the one in control. Live in that faith relationship rather than me stepping out from underneath his control and trying to control things on my own. All I've done, I'm firmly in the grasp of the illusion of control because I don't control it. I did not control the fact that my son died 35 years ago today. I did not control that whatsoever. And God reminded me on that day, Rick, you're not in control. As I watch my mother struggling with Alzheimer's and see her life declining, Rick, you're not in control. You can't just make it all better. You know what's going to come someday. As I get word this last weekend, Judy and I just went to Seattle this weekend to do a marriage conference to fill in for some good friends of ours who were supposed to go there. But a week before that conference in Seattle, she got word from the doctors, you've got cancer. We're not sure how long you'll be able to live. And God reminds me, Rick, you're not in control. She's not in control. They're not in control. And God uses this thing that strikes fear in our hearts and makes us doubt and wonder to keep reminding us of this. He's in control. And it keeps drawing us back to living by faith, not living with that illusion of control firmly in our grasp. That's the kind of life we were designed for. Number four, in an attempt to continue the illusion of control, even over death, mankind tends to do one of a few things. We tend to deny the finality of death through reincarnation or some kind of soul life. That's what mankind has often done. Or deny the reality of death by ignoring or running away from it. A lot of denial going on there. I don't know if any of you ever had the chance to read Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death. He wrote it after Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote her book a few years later. And he wrote about how do we as society, Western society, deal with death, that subject of death. And he says, not very well. He talked about we deny it, that we live in denial. We go through life just trying to ignore it and deny it, and it's not going to happen to me, and that happens to other people, but not to me, and not to mine, and all of that. It was a powerful book. It became an instant bestseller. He won a Pulitzer Prize for that book, The Denial of Death, because it made a lot of people in the Western world look at something they were not willing to look at very well, very clearly. Another thing that we do with this attempting to continue on with the illusion control is we convince ourselves that if we believe and hope enough, there will be something beyond death, that blind confidence. I don't have any basis for believing this. I just have to believe it kind of thing. Or we convince ourselves that it really doesn't matter as long as they have invested wisely in this life. We have some friends live in another part of the country who are not Christians, good friends. We really like them a lot. They had a son who was an athlete, and in high school, he had a a heart condition that developed while he was in the middle of an athletic activity, and he died on the field. He didn't get hit. It wasn't something like that. He just collapsed and died before they could get him to the hospital. And we got to know each other for a number of years. We had a lot of conversations, had dinners together, and spent time together as couples. And they were convinced that their son, they created a memorial fund for him at the high school and all kinds of things. Great, great folks, good people that way, did a lot of good things and all. But what they were trying to do was to prolong his life because they believed he was nothing more than in the ground, and that was it. And they were trying to take the good out of his life that they could and the good that they saw that could come out of his death and perpetuate it for other people. And that's all they had. And we would talk with them, and they would ask us about the hope that was within us about our son. And we would talk to them about our hope. And it wasn't a blind confidence or a blind conviction or a blind hope. There were reasons that we believed our son was not just in a better place, but was with the Lord. And we were able to share that with them and share why we believe what we believed. And when we talked with them about, well, why do you believe what you believe? Well, I don't know what else to believe. That's all I've ever heard. That's all I've ever known. That's all I've ever believed. And you saw the emptiness in their faces. And my heart aches for them to this day as I think about what they go through when they have their anniversaries of the son of their son's death and that sort of thing. It's an emptiness. My heart aches for them. Down deep inside, all of our denials as human beings and all of our self-deception will only turn around and betray us. Number five, God uses both the certainty of and the unpredictable timing of death to challenge mankind's illusion of superiority and control. It keeps reminding us, as I said a few minutes ago, who is in control. He's in control. He's designed us to live in that faith relationship with him, trusting him, the one who is in control, not for us to hang on to the illusion of control. Let me pray. Father, just on a personal note, I want to thank you for Kyle's life. You gave him to us for 5.5 years, and we learned a lot about love and joy from him. And we thank you for the gift that you gave us in him for 5.5 years. We thank you that we can have confidence based upon you and your word that he is with you and you are taking care of him and we will see him again someday. We thank you for that. God, I pray that you would help us to deal with this subject well. Some of us in this room are young, and it's easy to think that all eternity lies before us in this life form. Some of us are not so young, and it's a more and more pressing issue in our heart and mind. But God, I pray that you would awaken all of us to the reality that you are in control. You're the one in charge. Help us to live that faith relationship with you. Help us to humbly submit our hearts to you and allow our minds to be biblically formed by your word so that we can become more and more the people you designed us to be, living in a faith relationship with you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. You got some questions on your table. By the way, there is no class next week. We've got a week off for Easter, spring break, whatever you want to call it. We need to do that. And we'll come back, and we got two more. The last two classes, by the way, are going to be answering this question: how does death relate to life from a biblical point of view? And the very last class is going to be the entire semester in summation form, hopefully in a way that when we're done with that evening, you've got something in your hands that it all clicks together and makes sense. So it'll be a summary and review of what we've done this entire semester. And it's not because I'm just going to talk real fast, okay? But it's going to be in a condensed form, putting it all together the whole semester. Okay, have a good discussion. We'll see you in 2 weeks.